Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 21st, 2007, and this is show number 117. Oh man, I've been really busy on the whole podcasting circuit this last couple of weeks. Last week, I was on the Typical Mac User podcast with Victor Cajiao and had a great time doing that. This week, I worked on the Mac Roundtable with Tim Verporten, Steve Stanger, and Don McAllister. I don't know when that show's going to get posted, but I'll be sure to put a link in the show notes when I get that date. Anyway, I'm such a celebrity. You know, my time is in such demand. Speaking of demands, I've gotten a couple of requests in the past few weeks asking why on earth I do not have a car waxing tutorial on my website. What was I thinking? How did I not think of doing that? Well, you know, I'm all about the fans, so since I've been getting these requests, I know Pat has been waiting patiently for it. Anyway, Steve and I started working on it this weekend. My idea is to have a written tutorial that includes photos and little video vignettes of each step so you can follow along. Probably get more hits than my podcast. You never know. Well, I could tell that Victor Cajiao of the Typical Mac User podcast really got me when he actually named the episode he let me be on. He called it, "I'll Wax Your Car for a Mac." Ooh, maybe that's what I can do. I can wax cars for Macs. I like it. Anyway, stay tuned. I'll let you know when I get that important tutorial up. Well, you remember a little while ago when Ron and I went to the Podcast Expo, I told you that I got to be on a panel chatting about the merits and demerits of hacking the iPhone. Well, Bill Palmer of iProng.com did all the work of setting it up and hosting the show, and we were joined by Shubi Kumar of ShubiSaysThings.com. He's also known as America's Favorite Junior on Leo Laporte's radio show. See, he takes all the show notes for Leo. Anyway, I'm reminding you of all of this because Ron took a 45-minute video of the panel session, nearly breaking his arm holding up the video camera all that time. Then Steve edited it down to some nice sound bits, about an 18-minute video. We posted it up on Viddler, so I've embedded the video into the show notes, but I'll also be pushing the nice quality video into the podcast feed. So don't be alarmed when you get an 80 megabyte No Silicast later this week. I hope you enjoy it, and I give big thanks to Ron, Steve, Bill, and Shubi for making all of this possible. It was a lot of fun. By the way, you may be wondering why I didn't just put it up on YouTube. Well, they've got a limit of only 10 minutes. I could have made it a higher quality video, sucking up more bandwidth, but I couldn't figure out how to make it shorter. Steve and I edited out an awful lot to get it from 45 down to 18, and we just didn't want to cut any more out. So, luckily, Viddler.com allows you to go much longer. Well, it's time for a guilt trip combined with a testimonial. Have you backed up your computer this week? No? What are you, some kind of crazy person? Or perhaps you're just feeling lucky? Or maybe you just think it's too hard? Well, I used to be like you, but then I found Super Duper from shirt-pocket.com, and it changed my life. Well, if you've been listening for a while, you know that after 23 years of computing, I finally did have a disk crash, but I didn't lose one little thing because I had been using the trivially easy and intuitive backup software called Super Duper. All right, enough about me and you, though. Why do I mention it today? That's because listener Martin has been having a devil of a time with his first-generation MacBook. You know, they had a real overheating problem, and his is just overheating like crazy. The fans simply don't go on up to the right speed. They stay going real low when the temperature's real high. I thought you'd be inspired to do your own backup by the fact that he said he heard about Super Duper on the No Silicast, and that's why he knows his data is safe as he's had to send his MacBook in for repairs. So I ask you again, do you feel lucky? So remember last week I told a story about my son Kyle and how since he's 16, I'm an idiot. Remember that goes hand in hand? Well, he had recommended some software called iFlash to me, begrudgingly admitting that it might be cool if I talked about it on my podcast. I got the best email ever about it from listener Connor. Here's what he says. Hi, Allison. I'm a new subscriber to your podcast, and I learned about you from the Typical Mac User live podcast. After listening to just one episode, I really like your podcast. Also, I really appreciate the iFlash software. That's something I plan to use when I get my MacBook Pro when Leopard arrives. See, I'm a teenager too, but being only 14, I still think my mom is awesome. Just wanted to drop you a line. Max Rule, Connor. I love that email. I sent it to Kyle. See, he appreciates his mom. I got another fun email this week from Len Charnoff. Check this out. Hi, Allison. Just discovered your superb podcast. Kudos on so many compelling shows. You're spot on about the length of audio versus video. I'm preparing a podcast series on parrots. The picture I included in my email below is my 11-year-old Moluccan cockatoo. He's more than a legend in his own beak and was just written up on the Flector developmental blog. I'm in the research stage right now, and your podcast is a treasure chest of information. Thanks again, Len Charnoff. Well, thanks, Len, for your kind words. I love this. Really keeps me going when I read a letter like that. To the rest of you, I put a picture he sent me of his cockatoo in the show notes. It's a positively amazing photo of an amazing-looking bird. From a photography standpoint, it's amazing, too. It's just a really beautiful picture. Anyway, I also put a link to the blog showcasing this really neat-looking bird. You've got to see him to believe how cool he is. I know, this doesn't have a darn thing to do with freeware or shareware, but hey, it's my podcast, and I think it's cool. Do you remember your homework assignment? Man, this is just a podcast of guilt, isn't it? Well, anyway, your assignment was to tell at least one other person about the NoSilicast. Well, listener Margaret wrote in to tell me about how she helped to spread the word. She has a friend who does a radio show where he makes his recordings, but then he burns them to CDs and hands them out to his friends. She decided for his 50th birthday to help him get into this decade, and she gave him a gift basket that included instructions on how to turn his show into a podcast so more people can listen. She included information on the NoSilicast show so he can see how it's done. Have you done your homework assignment yet? Along these same lines, I'd like to play a little audio bit recorded by Adam Christensen of the MacCast and Victor Cahiao of the Typical Mac User podcast. Victor calls this clip Play It Forward, and he suggests that all podcasters include this in their show. Let's have a listen.
You all, obviously you're listening to this, you're involved with podcasts, you know about podcasts. We've all reached kind of a stasis in terms of audience. I know we've talked about this, Victor, but talked about this with a ton of other podcasters. It's sort of like none of us are really gaining a lot of new audience. We're not losing any audience either, which is great, and we absolutely love it. But it just seems like there's a whole huge group of people that aren't listening to podcasts yet.
Right.
And we just feel everybody should be listening to podcasts because of the advantages of, you can get whatever content when and where you want it. I mean, you all know, we don't need to sell you on why podcasting is great. But what I want to challenge people to do is go out and teach someone that you know how to get and listen to podcasts. Just one person. And if every person out there could just get one new person to listen to podcasts, we double our audience. And I think that's easy to do. You know, go to a family member or a friend, somebody who's not into podcasts, and just literally sit down for 10 minutes and show them how to subscribe to a podcast. And I don't care what podcast you have them subscribe to. You know, ask them what they're interested in. Go on iTunes, find them a show that's going to be relevant to them, and let's get more people hooked on podcasting.
So what do you think about that? We're not talking here about just listening to the shows you like, but to help them know about podcasting in general so they can find out what they're interested in. When I do this and I really want to get somebody amped up about podcasting, instead of talking about the technology, I first ask them what they're interested in. Let's say they say model trains, for example. I can dash over to Podcast Alley or Google or even iTunes and find a model train podcast, which, by the way, was harder than I thought. I would have thought there would have been more of those. But anyway, if you start with what they care about, it's the only way to engage them. After you let them listen for a bit, then you can explain how the technology lets them get the show delivered free of charge anytime the creator makes a new episode. Give it a try. Let's start accelerating podcasting again. Well, I've been blathering on for 8.5 minutes already, and now I'm actually going to talk about a piece of shareware I found. I found a tool that will only take a few seconds to describe and fills a very narrow niche, but it fills it so positively perfectly, I just love it. If you're a web designer, you spend a fair amount of time getting your colors just exactly the way you want them. In order to describe the color in HTML or CSS, you have to supply the hex code for the color. What that means in English is entering a number like #476CB8. That lets you describe kind of a dusty blue. But how do you find out what these numbers are? You can't just type in dusty blue and it knows that it's 476CB8. Well, what if you see the perfect dusty blue for your website and it's out, you know, you're looking at somebody else's site or it's in a photograph? How do you know that it's 476CB8? A great way to find out on the Mac is a free utility called Pipette from charcoaldesign.co.uk. When you launch Pipette, all you see is a blank square with a little eyedropper above it and a field that says #FFFFFF. Well, I sat there looking at that, going, okay, what do I do now? I didn't figure it out instantly, but eventually I got the hang of it. It's actually because it's too simple that you can't quite figure it out. You click on the eyedropper and drag your cursor from that window until you get to the color you want. The color you want can be literally anywhere. It can be a color in the photo on your desktop background. It can be in a web page. Heck, it could be the red color of your menu meters in your menu bar if you wanted. Just anywhere on screen where that color is actually showing. The blank square below the #FFFFF starts showing a blow-up of the pixels around your cursor, so you can move around till you get the exact color you were looking for. As you're whizzing around the screen, that hex field is showing the exact characters for the color you're on right at that exact instant. When you stop and let go, the hex code freezes to the number of the color you stopped on. Better yet, though, it becomes automatically selected. So that means all you have to do is copy and then paste your hex code into your HTML or CSS. Turns out there's another use for this. If you see the perfect color you want to use, but you want it in Photoshop Elements to color a background or something like that, how do you get it just right? Well, you need to figure out what the RGB codes are, or the hue and saturation, if you want. You could try to do that. Or you could just pop open Pipette, click on the color, and then paste it into the color field of the Photoshop Elements color picker. And voila, you're an artiste. Hope that helps somebody. It's a long description for something that's really very simple. It's fun to play with, too. Like I mentioned earlier in Connor's wonderful email talking about how much he loved the show and he's going to use iFlash, I did review this software, iFlash, which is a beautiful piece of inexpensive shareware for the Mac that creates flashcards on the fly very easily. Listener Martin wrote in to make another suggestion, which has some advantages over iFlash. Martin says, "About iFlash, I just want to point out an alternative, which is quite good and handy if you're trying to build flashcards, which can be used by all people, whether they're on Linux, Windows, or Mac OS X. It's called JMemorize from jmemorize.org. It is probably not as Mac-like and well-done as iFlash is, but it's freeware, and it's good for creating cross-platform flashcards." I love the idea of software that's open source and cross-platform so everyone can play. I headed over to jmemorize.org and checked out JMemorize. The J is for Java, which explains why it plays so well on all platforms. Java apps can be a bit hinky, though. For example, they won't naturally launch like regular applications with tools like Quicksilver. Not a big deal, just something to keep in mind. Some Java applications look weird, too. But JMemorize opens up with a nice set of buttons that look very Mac-like to me, at least for a Java app. You can create a new deck, open an existing deck, or save one you have open. Simple enough. Then you have Add, Edit, Reset, or Delete a card. There's a button to add a category. Not quite sure what that one means, but I guess you could have different categories of flashcards that you're working on. And then there's a Search button, and finally Learn. Let's try making a new deck. I'll start by making some cards. When you click to create a new card, You get a pop-up window that has a bunch of nice formatting options. Bold, italic, underline, as well as superscript and subscript. The best part is as soon as you fill in the front, side, and flip side, you can simply add or add and create next. You usually have a ton of flashcards you need to make at once, so that's a crucial feature that you can just keep going add and create next, add and create next, add and create next. Nice that you don't get in and out of it. From this pop-up menu, you can also edit cards you've already made. Clicking on Edit recently pops up a new window that lets you flip through your cards quickly to edit them. Once you finish making the cards, you get back to the main menu window, and it's there that it got slightly confusing. You get a bar chart with a couple of bars for summary and start deck. I didn't have bars beyond that, but there's room for 5 more decks. The legend says that it will be showing me unlearned cards, expired cards, and learned cards. I wasn't exactly sure what would happen with this, so I figure if I hit learn, maybe it would make sense. That popped up a window called Learn Settings. In there, I can choose to learn all or by category, also to learn all unlearned and expired cards versus only unlearned cards. Huh? I don't know exactly what an expired card is. Not sure what that means at all. It also allows you to set a time limit for how long to study. That might be a good way to force yourself to concentrate for a good long period. If you'd rather have a delimiter of how many cards to study, you can do that too. There was an advanced and scheduling section too, but I got scared and just wanted to start. Finally, I let it start the learning portion, and it shows a card and lets me tell it whether or not I know the answer. If I tell it on each card whether it's known, it starts changing the bar chart with green and gray bars moving all over the place. I don't think I ever did follow how the bars were changing or a pattern to what they were doing, but the main thing is that JMemorize showed me which ones I already knew and which ones I didn't know, and helped me easily flip through all the cards. I think JMemorize is a terrific program that will really help kids, or adults for that matter, to study whatever they're trying to learn. Check it out at jmemorize.org. Have you ever started using an application and suddenly you just say to yourself, wow. I had that reaction this week when reviewing Pixelmator from pixelmator.com. You know I'm a big whiner, and I can find problems in almost any piece of software, right? It's actually rare that I can be wowed. Wait. I'm forgetting something here. Oh yeah, what problem am I solving? Well, how about the never-ending holy grail search for an alternative to the $600 program of Photoshop or the $80 Photoshop Elements that hasn't been upgraded significantly in pretty much forever for the Mac. As you may recall, I reviewed the new Acorn application a few weeks ago. I was a bit lukewarm on it. Everybody else is all excited about it, but it was pretty cool. But there's web-based applications that seem to do pretty much everything Acorn can do. I was worried maybe I'm too much of a critic when I heard people like Alex Lindsay of the Pixel Corps singing its praises on MacBreak Weekly. Acorn may help you if you really hate the idea of your photos being up on the web somewhere. Might even want to be creating original content, in which case none of those solutions would be right for you. Anyway, with all of this in mind, it was kind of a yawn stage when somebody told me about Pixelmator. I thought, okay, fine, I'll download and install it, play around a little bit, and move on. But the minute I started running Pixelmator, I actually leaned back in my seat as I took in the beautiful GUI. It was stunning. All of the palettes and tools are in this translucent, very dark gray, so they're very classy looking. Palettes come and go as you change context. Like if you choose a selection tool, instead of a tiny little icon changing in the toolbar as it does in Photoshop Elements, you get a floating tool options palette where you can choose the selection mode from single to additive to subtractive. Same thing as in Photoshop Elements, but, I don't know, prettier. It's very pleasing to the eye, but it might take up screen real estate you'd prefer to have open. I was gonna say that was a downside to this tool, but luckily the Pixelmator folks thought of that too. You can toggle on and off the display of tools, tools options, basically any of the palettes on screen are an option to you. Very nice. When you select a tool in the palette, it enlarges to show you which one of the tools you've selected, So like if you click on the paint bucket, for example, instead of it just being, you know, indented or something, it's this big, fat, cartoony looking paint bucket. So it, I don't know, it just kind of stands out really nice. It's a pleasing effect because your brain doesn't have to do a lot of work and the graphics are nice. Well, I've been a big Photoshop Elements fan for years, and a long time ago I read a book on Photoshop Elements by Scott Kelby, in which he explained that if you're paid by the hour, you should carefully drag your cursor over to the tool you want, click on it to select, and then go back over to where you're going to work. He further explained that if you're paid to produce a product, not by the hour, maybe you'll want to use the key combinations to select tools instead. I love Kelby's way of explaining things. I'd read anything by him. Well, anyway, because of that advice, I made a point to memorize the key combinations for most of the tools that I use all the time in effects. Like, for example, if you hit V, it selects the Move tool. C selects the Crop tool, and so on. It's not Command-C or Control-C. It's just C is Crop tool. I was delighted to find that Pixelmator follows the same conventions. They use the same letters. So I don't have to learn it all over again. In Photoshop Elements, if you hold down on a tool, it tells you what the key is you need to hit to trigger it. I thought I found a gap in Pixelmator because I held down on the tool and it did not show it to me. And that's when I figured out that if you just hover over the tool, it does show you that key trigger. Dang it, can't find anything wrong with this tool yet. Well, a lot of people buy their computers with high-end graphics cards because they think they need them to do photo editing and video, when in fact those programs use your processors to do all the calculations. Video games that are constantly rendering new images on screen do use your graphics cards, so you do need high-end graphics cards for those games, but traditional photo editing, you're just wasting your money buying a good graphics card. That is, until Pixelmator. Pixelmator actually uses your graphics card for image processing, freeing up your processors to do the other heavy lifting. You might hear people talk about core graphics. It's some technical term I don't completely understand in the Mac OS, but Pixelmator is taking advantage of that and is accessing your graphics card directly for these things. I wanted to prove to myself that this wasn't just hype and lingo and that sort of thing. So I tried doing a function that's commonly done on photos called unsharp mask. The idea of unsharp mask is, I know, it's counterintuitive because technical people wrote it. Unsharp mask means to sharpen a photo, make the edges a little crisper if the photo's a little dull. In Photoshop Elements, when you do that, a window comes up showing you the radius and intensity of the effect, and you get a preview option so you can see how changing the options, you know, the little sliders, will get you what you want. Once it looks pretty good, you hit OK, and off goes the processor to work on the photo to actually apply this effect. On my 2-year-old MacBook Pro, it can take a couple of seconds for this effect to be applied. But in Pixelmator, the same sort of window pops up, but real time, while I'm sliding the intensity and radius back and forth, the picture is changing. I thought, OK, that's cute, it's just the preview. But there's no OK button to hit. It's just already done as you're doing this. I definitely can see the benefit of core image processing technologies employed by Pixelmator. It's not hype. Well, iPhoto is also integrated into Pixelmator using the image browser. It did take a long time to start showing me my photos, though, and my iPhoto library is not very big at all because I don't trust it. But that's another story. Well, anyway, once the image browser was up, I could browse through by event and open photos from thumbnails within the image browser. It's not a nice thing to have, but I wouldn't put it down as a huge differentiator. I can browse my desktop pretty easily because I keep my photos organized that way. But if you use iPhoto for all your photos, this would really be a big deal for you, I think. Well, you remember earlier in the show, I talked about the software Pipette, the tool that lets you pick a color and then apply it in Photoshop. I tried to show off how Pipette could help in Pixelmator too, but when I opened the color picker in Pixelmator, I realized that there was a magnifying glass right there that performed the same function of Pipette. All you do is click on the magnifying glass, and you can wander all over the screen, even outside of the Pixelmator window, And wherever you land, the color picker grabs that color. Wow, that's another enhancement over Photoshop Elements. Try as I might, I could not find a downside to Pixelmator. I looked and looked and looked, but all I found was a lot to set it apart from other image editors. Now, Pixelmator is $59, but that makes it $20 less than the Mac version of Photoshop Elements 5, which, like I said, hasn't been upgraded in ages, even though they've come out with the PC version 6 quite a while ago. Adobe is not keeping up the Mac version for some reason, so if I had $60 to $80 to spend on a photo editor image creator, I would pick Pixelmator over Photoshop Elements in a heartbeat. Pixelmator even launches 10 times faster on my MacBook Pro than Photoshop Elements. I'm using Photoshop Elements 4, by the way. Pixelmator took 2.2 seconds to launch when it was already cached, while Photoshop Elements was a ghastly 21.6 seconds, even though it was already cached. I don't know about you, but I actually changed all my JPEGs to launch Preview a while ago, just so I don't accidentally launch Photoshop Elements and have to, like, go have dinner while I wait for it to come up. Now I can set them to Pixelmator with no fear of lost productivity. I am a fairly cranky reviewer, as you know. I'm not afraid to say what I don't like about a piece of software. As I wrote this review, I tried and tried and tried to find something that didn't work the way I wanted it to in Pixelmator, but I was thwarted at every turn by easy-to-use menus, fast processing, beautiful design. Check it out yourself at pixelmator.com. You know, when I first got started doing the podcast, I used to do movie reviews of our Friday night viewings. I don't remember why I stopped doing them. Maybe too much cool software got in the way. Anyway, Friday night, Steve and I watched the movie Transformers. It was awesome. This is a movie for everyone, seriously. Obviously, the kids are going to like it, you know, a little bit older kids, because it is pretty violent, but not gory violent. It's totally a muscle car fanatic movie, too. It's got a hot Camaro, a Mustang, some big old GMC trucks. Definitely a man's man's movie. Plus, it's a chick film, because the girl is not only hot, she's a mechanic. It's a geek film, because there's a pudgy geek who does Morse code and a girl who's the code breaker. In case you're in doubt about the geek angle, it's got the fast food Taco Bell angle going too, with a beloved chihuahua. Heck, he even has a broken leg so you feel sorry for him. It's even more of a chick flick because early on, you meet a serviceman who has a baby he has yet to hug. So you know he's not going to get killed, right? They wouldn't do that. There's lots of computer graphics and tons of explosions. It's all good. In spite of all this, it's totally realistic because the hot chick mechanic has chipped fingernails in the final scene. I really appreciate that level of attention to detail and knowing what realism is all about. Well, if all this hasn't given you enough reason to see it, one of the minor heroes is the actor Josh Duhamel, who used to play Leo Dupre in All My Children. Remember him? He fell off a bridge to his death, but they never found the body, but his widow Greenlee almost killed herself, but she fell in love with Ryan Lavery later, but Ryan couldn't deal with all of his pain for the fact that his father was a domestic violence expert, so first he had a vasectomy and later pretended to die too, which threw Greenlee into a tailspin, but she decided to have Ryan's baby after his death because it turns out Ryan had donated his sperm before the vasectomy, but right before fertilized embryos were implanted, Zach had the power cut off to the clinic. Wait, what did this have to do with a review of Transformers? Perhaps I slightly digressed. Oh well, you're gonna love the movie because there's Max in it too. I got an email from Benjamin, a recent switcher, and his story of how he got into this Mac nonsense really tickled me. He told me he was a recent switcher and that he loved his Mac. I expressed a little bit of surprise that he loved it so quickly because it had only been a couple of months. Usually there's at least a bit of a learning curve before learning to love it. So I was curious why he was so happy so soon. I thought you might enjoy his answer. Quick explanation about why I love my new toy so soon after purchasing it. I'm a bit of a geek. I had taken every single Tiger tutorial online, was a regular on Apple Insider and Mac Rumors, I had visited the Apple Store twice a week for almost a year, and I was already listening to macOS Ken and Adam Christensen for 2 or 3 months before my switch. I was sailing as soon as I pulled my iMac out of the box. I was planning on waiting for Leopard, but at long last, I could not. I've gotten every bit of the $130 in early enjoyment that I would have saved by waiting. True story, I canceled my online order and drove to the Apple Store in the same day because I could no longer wait to ship it to my house. I love this guy. Benjamin, you're our people. Well, this week, Honda Bob is off on a big adventure driving across the country, and he asked me what he could do to be able to control his PC while he's on the road. I turned him on to GoToMyPC at GoToMyPC.com, which I've heard should be able to do the trick for him. I haven't used it myself because it is Windows only, but I knew they had a 30-day trial, so maybe this will do the trick for him. He tested it out before he left, and he said it worked great. Hey, maybe he'll do a review for us when he gets back. I love having a mechanic who's a geek. It's nice to be able to talk the same language with him, you know? That makes him perfect for working on our cars because he's willing to get into the technical bits with us and explain things really well. He doesn't even charge extra for the explanations. Sometimes I think he should charge Steve. It's almost like every tune-up includes a car repair tutorial for him. If you'd like to have a mechanic who speaks your language, is willing to explain what's going on with your car instead of saying things like, "Don't worry your pretty little head about it, give me $800. If you'd like to have a mechanic who drives to your house to keep your Honda or Acura car in top running condition, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. Remember, he's only in LA and Orange County, so you'll have to move if you don't live in that area. HA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, now it's time for a word from our second sponsor, the Wall Street Journal. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week that talked about phishing scams. He referred to the links and email that look so real. The article said, "Block a phishing attack and your company is safe for a day. Teach employees how to spot phishing attacks and your company is safe for life." Anyway, the author went on to provide a quiz. They gave 5 web addresses and asked if you can tell which ones are real and which ones are run by a hacker. Here are the 5 addresses they gave: ebay.verification.com, www.da-us.chase.com/cgibin, secure.citibanking.net, pages.ebay.com/services/form/feedback.html, and finally www.secure-account.com/regionsbank. So which ones are real? It turns out that the part of the addresses that matter come right before the .com or the .net. So the ones that had chase.com, citibanking.net, and ebay.com in them are all legitimate. Anything that comes after the slash just represents a page on the site. So how do you figure out what address the link in the email is actually pointing to? Remember that frequently it would say something correct like ebay.com, but if it said, if you hover over it, the little URL will pop up and actually say the real URL, which is how you can tell whether it's a fake one. Anyway, I love the Wall Street Journal for things like this. It's so practical and informative. I mean, they gave this great example that taught people exactly how to solve this problem. I learned another thing from the Wall Street Journal this week. There's an interesting new technique being employed for kidney transplants. Okay, here's the setup. Let's say you need a kidney and your spouse volunteers, but they're not a match. There's a woman in Des Moines who needs a kidney too, and her brother volunteers, but he isn't a match either. This new program they've set up will match your spouse's kidney with the woman in Des Moines and her brother's kidney with you. Everybody wins. It's tricky though, because you've got to find all these matches and you got to kind of do this cross-pollination thing. And what if you give a kidney to one person, but then the other person's spouse or sibling or whatever backs out before the kidney gets to you? Well, what they do on this new technique is they actually time the transplants to be at the exact same time. It's got to get really complicated. Well, let's take it up a notch. What if they could find a 3 or a 4 or a 5-way swap and 5 people could get kidneys because of the way they did it? It turns out they described in the Wall Street Journal that they're actually using the software they use to manage airline traffic to time all of these transfers. Isn't that fascinating? It's a great idea, and they're upping the number of kidney transplants dramatically because of this. Well, if you'd like to be able to read fascinating articles like this in the Wall Street Journal yourself, click on the link on my website for the online or print journal and subscribe for yourself. I love it. I wouldn't give it up for anything. Well, I wish I were a visionary. Some people can just see a new way of doing things and can make this whole thing better for us. I go to Google every day and I'm happy. Other people think, man, Google search is great and all, but it hasn't changed in ages. So what can we do that's more? Well, my friend Bob just turned me on to a whole new idea that might change everything. Have you heard of cluster search? There's an open source project dedicated to it called Carrot2. That's C-A-R-R-O-T, the number 2.org. Carrot2 can automatically organize or cluster your search results into thematic categories. Okay, thematic categories. Thanks for the IT speak, guys. Well, I think I can explain what thematic categories are best by the example that Bob showed me. He took me to the demo site for Carrot at demo.carrot2.org. In the search field, he types Star Trek. Okay, think for a minute. Imagine you've just typed that into Google. Yes, close your eyes and bask in the glow of the 28 billion hits you would get, sorted only by how many people had linked to that site. Now open your eyes and look what Carrot returns instead. Down the left pane, I get what looks like a series of folders on a hard drive. The top containing folder says All Results. Under that, the searches are in separate folders or thematic categories if you must. Those categories are things like Star Trek Next Generation, movie/TV, Star Trek fan, New Voyager, and so on. The main thing is that it's not just a pile of unrelated stuff. They found the connections between the different hits for Star Trek and made sense out of those connections. If you click on any of these thematic categories, you get the actual hits in the right pane with the title, a snippet from the site URL where the hit was found, along with which search engines found that particular hit. If you hover over a hit, the background turns pale yellow, and then the thematic category in which it was found also lights up yellow. I didn't completely understand the counts at first because it said it got 95 hits for Star Trek, but it turns out that you can set how many hits it's going to return, and the default is for about 100 hits. When you enter a search term, I should mention that there are a series of tabs across the top to change what you're searching with, and these are actually kind of interesting. The default first tab is just web, and web actually goes out to a bunch of different search engines and divides them up evenly. So if you have 5 search engines and you're getting 100 hits, you're going to get the top 20 hits from each one of those. The second tab is Yahoo News, followed by Wiki, which actually means Wikipedia. The next few tabs are unfamiliar to me. The first one was ODP, which I figured out by some digging around is the Open Directory Project Data. That sounds like fun. Better check that out. You can also search in jobs from Indeed.com and PubMed, the medical database. Finally, there's a tab for more where you can turn on more tabs or turn on off the existing ones. You can turn on regular Yahoo and Google and MSN. You can even drag and drop the tabs to change the order you like. So if you want to just search through one engine, you can do it, but you're going to still get those nice thematic categories on the left-hand side. The bottom line here is that this is an open source project that's really opening up how different and more valuable search can really be. Check out this idea at carrot2.org. Well, it looks like that's going to wrap it up for the week. Remember, you got a lot of work to do. You got to go run a backup. You got to check out the typical Mac user or Mac Roundtable podcast. Don't forget to do your homework of telling someone about the NoSillaCast and your assignment to tell someone about podcasting in general. Man, you got a lot of work to do. What are you doing sitting around? Get to it. Anyway, keep up all the great feedback by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com or send me an audio feedback at NoSillaCast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.